Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, I was on Star Trek.
Which one?
It was the one with the main Klingon guy with the big eyebrows. And he's having some argument in the foreground. Way in the background, there's me and my buddy sitting at a table eating fruit salad.
What's in a Klingon fruit salad?
Oh, grapes, bit of melon, orange melon.
Turn your speakers up to 11 because it's time for Too Much Effing Perspective, the podcast that asks musicians and entertainers to relive their most Spinal Tap moments when nothing goes right and everything gets kind of weird. I'm your host, Alan Keller, a comedy writer in Los Angeles and former lead singer of the least heralded Chicago band, The Falling Walendas.
And I'm your co-host, Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead and former lead singer of the least heralded Milwaukee band, The Vainglorious.
Our guest today is 2002 Rock and Roll Hall of Famer and six-time Grammy winner, Stuart Copeland from The Police.
We talk with Stuart about the time he quote-unquote fractured Sting's ribs wrestling over a copy of the New York Times. How many more great albums The Police could have recorded if only they hadn't broken up? And why it was necessary to call 911 when Cream drummer Ginger Baker jammed in Stuart's studio.
So without further ado, let's go to the TMEP show.
It really puts perspective on things, though, doesn't it?
Not too much. It's too much fucking perspective now.
Alex, in one of our recent episodes, the one with Devo co-founder Jerry Casale, he talked very honestly about his contentious relationship with bandmate Mark Mothersbaugh.
Yeah, he did.
And Jerry told us that when he and Mark started Devo, it was a true art collective. But as Devo got more famous and Mark became the face of the band, Jerry said Mothersbaugh got a case of lead singeritis, as Jerry called it, and began right. to make more and more decisions without consulting his partner. And the music suffered.
It obviously caused a rift that really never healed. Jerry made that really clear in the stories he told us. And you and I were both surprised when we learned that those guys still actually play together.
Absolutely. But you know, this lead singeritis is really common in rock bands and can screw up a good thing. It either diminishes the music, like I think it did with the later Talking Heads albums, as David Byrne became increasingly dictatorial. It leads to key band members quitting, like Kim Deal did when she left the Pixies for the Breeders because she couldn't get any of her songs through Black Francis. Mm-hmm. Or it leads to the band breaking up altogether like it did with Stewart's band, The Police.
Yeah. And based on what we heard, what began as a collaboration of The Police gradually became more and more about Sting as he began controlling the creative process. And it led to a lot of battles between those three guys. Ultimately, Sting walked away and started a solo career thinking he didn't need his bandmates anymore.
And you know what's the proof that he's wrong? His solo career. Because in my opinion, the five albums he put out with Stewart and guitarist Andy Summers are exponentially better than anything he did on his own.
Alan, well, mathematics are never your strong suit. At most, it was logarithmically. But in any case, I got to tell you, I am actually a bigger fan of Sting's solo stuff. I love songs like Russians, Be Still My Beating Heart, We Work the Black Seam. Those have a special place and time in my memory.
Oh, so you have the same musical taste as my mother. Interesting. Okay, to be honest, you brought up my two favorite Sting solo songs in Russians and Black Seam. And just to remember, those were from his first post-Police solo album, so he still had some residual magic there. But I think his body of work since The Police doesn't remotely compare to what he did with the band. I mean, come on, Roxanne, Message in the Bottle, Every Breath You Take, those are some of the best songs ever. And it goes to show that he needed Stewart and Andy to do his best work. I'm sorry. That's been proven by other musicians too who failed as solo artists, like Freddie Mercury did after Queen, Billy Corgan from the Smashing Pumpkins, Mick Jagger, Roger Daltrey. The list goes on and on.
Yeah. Unfortunately for Jagger, he stayed close to the Stones, and Daltrey and Pete Townshend and The Who are still out doing their thing. But it is certainly evident that ego can be a dangerous thing. And that's why bands like REM, U2, and my old tour mates Radiohead seem pretty smart looking back. They realized early on that regardless of who wrote a song, the alchemy of the band is what made their music special. And that's why, surprisingly, those bands split their credits and royalties evenly. I didn't even know that about Radiohead.
Well, I hope you don't get any ideas from that, because when this podcast starts cranking out the bucks, I want the split to reflect our relative importance to the show. And, you know, 80-20 seems effing fair, don't you think?
Sure, Alan. You are nearly 80, so I'm happy to give you 20.
That's not what I meant, but I have to get in hair and makeup now. So call me when you're ready. I'm going to be in my dressing room, okay?
Alan, that's not the dressing room. That's your bathroom. Listeners, while Alan suffers from a bout of podcast hostitis, let's get to our talk with the great Stewart Copeland. But first, a short break.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are The Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like the Shadows.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
And now a man who scored music for films like Wall Street, Rumblefish, and Talk Radio, as well as TV shows like The Equalizer and Dead Like Me, police drummer Stewart Copeland. Stewart, you had a really great insight that the hierarchy in rock and roll is based on chronology. So that the Foo Fighters look at you as being a legend, you look at Ringo Starr as being a legend.
You know, that hierarchy thing just keeps it simple.
Yeah.
We don't have to get into a pissing match about how many tickets we sold or records or, you know, we don't need to Google each other at the dinner table. We just know you came before me, therefore I bow and scrape before thee. And then, you know, like dogs, as soon as they establish the hierarchy, they all relax. Even if you're at the bottom or the middle or the top, you know your place. We're all good.
Well, it's interesting. We had Dan Wilson on from Semisonic, and he got to write with Carole King. Dan said to her, so how do you feel about the Beatles covering Chains, your song? I mean, the most influential band ever covered you. And she goes, well, to be honest, they list me as an influence.
You got me there. What time did the Beatles ever do a song that they didn't write?
They did it a lot in the early days. I mean, Twist and Shout is the Isley Brothers. Roll Over Beethoven is Chuck Berry. Honey Don't is Carl Perkins. You Really Got a Hold on Me is Smokey Robinson. And Chains was written by Carole King and her husband at the time, Jerry Goffin. Chains, my baby's got me locked up in chains.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Was Carole King even born then?
Carole King's way before that. She did Respect.
Aretha Frank. Get out of
here. Yeah. Oh, my God. She's
done.
Now
I got some respect. I only ever heard of her in the context of the early 70s, you know, her own solo album she came out with, which was boring. And now she wrote Respect. Now I got some.
She and her husband wrote so many of the incredible hits from the 60s.
Wow.
You have to look that up.
So that picture of her on the front of her first solo album, Tapestry, she looks like the same age as everybody else, but must have had some airbrush in there because she's clearly a lot older than she looked on that album cover.
Well, she did start when she was 7, so.
Well, I share that same distinction. The first Police album cover for America, they airbrush that to make us all look 12.
Really? Outlandos?
Well, look at that Outlandos d'amour. There we are all, you know, like three tweens.
Listeners, this is Alan here to fact check myself. Very embarrassing that I would tell Stuart Copeland from The Police that Carole King wrote Aretha Franklin's hit Respect. Of course she didn't. Otis Redding did. But Carole did write another Aretha hit, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, as well as Locomotion, The Monkees' Pleasant Valley Sunday, James Taylor's You've Got a Friend, The Animals' Don't Bring Me Down. I mean, she actually has over 110 hits that made the Billboard Hot 100. So Stuart, if you're listening, I was wrong about Respect, the song, but not about the respect that we all should pay Carole King. So please accept my apologies. Back to the show. I read your entire book, Strange Things Happen, and you wrote, there is an old joke from the film This Is Spinal Tap where the band goes on stage and greets the audience with Hello Cleveland, only it isn't Cleveland. Truth is, it might as well be. To us, it feels like the same city night after night. That is a moment in Spinal Tap that pretty much 75% of our guests recall, right, Alex?
Yeah.
Even if they haven't seen the movie, they know the gag.
Yeah.
That's right. That's part of the Spinal Tap wisdom, right? But in 2007 in Turin, Italy, you had kind of the same getting lost to the stage moment, right?
Oh, yeah. Would you like to hear that story?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was whatever the heck year it was. And we were deep into the tour and we're playing a crumbly old football stadium. Now, football stadiums are designed so that the team comes out of the side of the stadium into the center of the field. Well, rock bands, they come in at one end of the stadium. So we leave our dressing rooms and get into a little bus to drive around to the other end of the stadium. And we're driving and suddenly we're chatting away. It's actually Sting's birthday that day. And we're all a happy band going to play a happy show. And by the way, 2 hours later, we were screaming at each other. But it was still, at this point, it was still Sting's birthday. We're a cheerful band. And we look out the window of our little bus and we see that we're going on an on-ramp onto a freeway. And we look out the window and the giant stadium, which blocks out the sky, is receding. What? And it's rush hour, by the way, around whatever time it is we go on stage. So and then we're getting back off the freeway on the next off-ramp. And we're crossing over the bridge, and there's a stadium coming back up. Well, that was an interesting little detour. By the way, we have full-on police escort. The lights going, the cars in front, cars in behind, motorcycles on either side. The mighty police shall take the stage by way of some diversion. Okay, so we're back off the off-ramp. We're back into the stadium parking lot, and we're driving up the parking lot, and we take a left at the top of the thing. Drive for a little bit, then we take a right in the parking lot, then we stop for a minute, then we take a left and drive, and now we're lost in the parking lot with the police like, the motorcycle guys and everything, lost in the stadium parking lot. And the crackle comes over from the tour manager, Billy, who is our guy, with a dry sense of humor. So is the band going to play a show tonight? We're now 20 minutes into our set, stuck, lost in the parking lot. The entourage stops. The lights go out. The sirens stop. The motorcycle cops are kind of standing there looking Italian. And I can just imagine the two guys in the front of the eye, up the cops. And finally, we make it to the gig.
Unbelievable.
Maybe half an hour late. And it just turned out. That coincidentally, with that wonderful, cheerful story, was the night of the worst screaming match of the tour on stage in front of 80,000 Italians and probably one of the best shows we ever played. But from considering the noise that came off the audience, I guess those Italians, they do like their gladiator fights. But, it was understandable. We get there, we get into whatever song that was, When the World is Running, whatever. Anyhow, Andy takes a guitar solo. And he lights it up. I mean, that guy takes a guitar solo. He takes it up. Okay, I confess the tempo might have just gone up a tad.
Oh, no.
So that when Stingo comes back to the verse and he's got to sing his song, he's got to, spit the lyrics out too fast. He can't, and then
unknown to me that those actually lyrics sort of mean something. I can't hear what he's shouting at. All I just see is the back of his head. Anyhow, uh-oh, he's not going to like this. And sure enough, he's looking daggers over his left shoulder. And I'm just blasting away there. And pretty soon his daggers are turning into, you know, Scud missiles. And he's shouting, you know, and I can't hear him. He's off mic as he's turned around facing me. But he's screaming at me. And he's showing me with the back, just play the back beat. And he's showing me the back beat like that, you know, in front of 80,000 paying customers. And so now, unfortunately, this does very little to calm me down. In fact, now I'm screaming, are you fucking kidding? And my cymbals are pinned like that. The drums are just going click, clack, because I'm just hitting them too hard. And now I've got Jeff, my guy, coming over the earbuds, feeling a little happy tonight. As I'm just trying to, I've got white balloons popping behind my eyeballs, just a red mist of fury. And the Italians are loving it. Man, this is better than lions going at it, you know. And so we burned down that stadium. Happy birthday, Stingo. Good times, good times.
Yeah.
You have a notoriously rocky relationship within the police. You actually broke Sting's rib once, didn't you?
In jest.
Yeah, in jest.
It was a hairline fracture. That was Shea Stadium. After the sound check, he grabbed for my New York Times and I wanted it back. And we ended it, you know, meanwhile, every journalist from England is there. For England, it's a big deal when an English band, even though I'm Merkin, it was a London band. When an English band plays Shea Stadium, they like that. It's like the Beatles conquering America. And so they're there. After the sound check, we're clowning around, more like the Monkees. You know, we're a little fisticuff, little tussle over my newspaper. I wanted it back. Pretty soon, I've got a knee applied to his rib cage, and both on either end of the New York Times. Then somebody's like, oh, God damn it, Copeland. Jesus Christ. And anyhow, we played a great show, but the next day, you got an x-ray, and okay, hairline fracture. But we were laughing.
That is fun. It's always the big things, right?
Well, it's a great story.
Yeah.
The police used to fight so hard, they used to break each other's ribs one time, you know.
Yeah.
Except the half the stories have him breaking my rib. Hey, look, dude, if you're going to make a myth, could you at least have it be the right way around?
You know, I was the front man, and how I kept my bands together was by allowing the musicians in my band to have agency over their parts, right? You're the expert at drums, you do the drums. You're the expert at lead guitar, you play lead guitar. I was really surprised when I was watching a lot of videos that Sting pulled like a McCartney Harrison thing. He was really getting his opinion in on everybody's parts, didn't he?
Yeah, and the times when it was most annoying was when he was right.
Yeah,
that's when the homicidal urge, I couldn't resist it. You know, my fingers would be reaching for that jugular. No, but at the beginning, we were codependent, and he'd pull out a song if we gave it any attention at all. Gosh, you guys like my song? Cool. Yeah. Okay. Five albums in, he's written 10 hits now. By the way, he's no longer a novice in the studio. At the beginning, Andy and I knew what we were doing in the studio. Sting, it was his first time. But after, you know, two or three albums, he's a quick study, that guy. And so he writes the songs at home, at leisure, with a very clear idea of the whole picture. He kind of knows how to use a drum set, how to use a guitar, and how to use the bass. And so he arrives in the studio, and any deviation from that pristine perfection that he's conceived in his mind is a struggle. It's not a collaboration anymore. It's a compromise. And I'm impressed that he stuck it out with these compromises for five albums. The first two were kind of easy. Zenyatta, the third album, was when the cracks began to show, and I could see him just getting frustrated, and me getting frustrated. He came over and started telling me what to do on the drums. Like, are you kidding? That's where it began, and it just developed over the next Ghost in the Machine, way out on Montserrat, this paradise that we soon turned into a living hell. And then I was surprised we even got into the studio for a fifth album, Synchronicity.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, tying that back to your story at the onstage kerfuffle in Turin, I tour managed this band called the Bodines long ago, and the singer and guitar player fancied himself to be a drummer as well. And so I remember the drummer telling me on the side, saying, you know, when Kurt, the singer, puts his foot back behind him and he's tapping on the stage. It's not because he's digging the beat. He's trying to be my metronome. So
yeah,
heard that kind of story before.
Oh, yeah.
But Stuart, you are one of the great drummers ever. And, you know, I love Sting. I love the Police. But there's so many experiences in the history of bands where the front man doesn't appreciate the alchemy of the unit, right?
Well, he's facing the other direction to give him some slack. He's not looking at the band. He's looking at the audience. He's working the crowd. There's something going on behind him, which may or may not be to his liking, but his focus is forward. The drummer and the bass player are behind him. Okay, he can kind of see the guitarist out of the corner of his eye, but the rhythm section is like kicking him up the ass or not.
I love it. I was watching your documentary and I can't remember what the song is, but it looks like an old Charlie Chaplin film. You guys are playing the song so fast, nailing it. But I'm like, is this sped up? Because this is incredibly, let's say, energetic.
Yes. Well, there's one shot of Andy looking and you can quite clearly see the words coming out of his mouth. Go fast.
The crux of the movie, This Is Spinal Tap, getting back to our thing, is that this is a band that's overstayed its welcome. And the Police obviously did not overstay their welcome. They ended at their peak, right, with Synchronicity, their fifth album. I'm just wondering, you know, a lot of bands kind of keep going into the sunset and start churning out inferior material. How many more albums do you think you guys could have cooked at that quality?
None.
Really?
You know, we worked it, we did it, it was perfect. And when we came back 20, 30 years later and pulled it off the shelf, it was untarnished.
Mm.
And of course, we drove each other nuts straight back into it. At first, we're thinking, we're older, wiser now.
Mature.
Yeah, mature. There you go. But no, straight from the first rehearsal, we're wondering what planet that other guy's on.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And by the way, when we get out of the band room and we go for dinner, get along great. Always have. It's only the music, which is weird considering the only thing we ever argued about was the music.
Well, I'll quote you, Sting and I can be good friends as long as we don't talk about music.
Really? That's the way we are now. That's why there's no more Police tour, because I enjoy getting along so well.
Yeah.
That is so funny because I read your book last night and I'm like, is this 2007 or is this 1984? It's the same stuff 20 years later, right?
Well, which book are you talking about? My current book, Police Diaries?
Not the current book, Strange Things Happen.
Okay, Strange Things Happen, all these stories of the reunion tour. By the way, my current book is about the time before that, the starving years, and that's about 1977, 78. With a little of 76, when we didn't have any of those big songs. He hadn't started writing yet. Andy joined about halfway through that. We were already at it for a year before we ran into Andy. And Sting and I stuck together, just codependent as a work and rhythm section. And before we had the music that we were going to play, we hadn't figured out the reggae thing. He hadn't started writing songs yet. But just as a rhythm section, we had a pocket that is the holy grail of all ensemble playing.
Well, talking about those early years, a great Spinal Tap moment happened back in 1978 when your solo project, Clark Kent, had a hit, Don't Care, and you performed it on Britain's really important show, Top of the Pops.
Yes.
And of course, you don't actually play live on Top of the Pops, you mime your song. And so you had Sting, Andy, and your brother Miles performing with you in masks.
And gorilla masks, because it was a secret identity. Nobody knew who Clark Kent is. That they're wondering, is it Frank Zappa? Is it, you know, whoever? And it wasn't. It was the drummer in this dodgy fake punk band going nowhere called the Police. You can Google it, Top of the Pops. And old Sting goes there and Andy too. And you can spot him right away. No gorilla mask can conceal that charisma.
Well, now they made a game show out of that, The Masked Singer. So they
That's right, yeah.
ripped you off 40 years later. Whatever.
That's right. We were before our time.
Speaking of your brother, Miles, he is a prominent manager in the music business and founded IRS Records. And your late brother, Ian, started a booking agency, FBI, Frontier Booking International. And with you being a recording artist, you three basically made up a vertically integrated music conglomerate. That's a unique relationship. How'd you guys get along?
I got along fine with both of my brothers. Ian, I was probably closest to. He was the next sibling up. But those two, Miles and Ian, fought like cat and dog. Because Ian would sign a band like REM that he put together. They were, one of them was his office boy down in Macon, Georgia. And he goes to Miles, look, you got to sign this band. And Miles goes, I don't get it. I don't hear it. I don't get it. If you're not signing REM, I'm not booking Squeeze. And Miles would sign these bands to his record label. And Ian said, I'm not booking that. You're kidding me. I'm not going to call up any of my promoters because this band sucks. They fought amongst each other while I'm the youngest sibling, just watching them go at it and trying to stay out of trouble.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Here's another moment for you. Okay, so my brother had his agency, Frontier Booking International, or otherwise known as FBI, and he's working late one day, and his receptionist knocks off at 6 o'clock, and he's answering the phones himself. Phone rings, he says, hello, Ian Copeland, FBI. And the voice on the other end goes, no, this is the FBI. And they're saying, what are you doing, you know, impersonating a federal officer? Ian says, hey, look, you send a guy over here, and if you find anybody in my office impersonating FBI agent, arrest him on the spot and drag him out of here.
Wow.
Although we have presidential papers in the bathroom.
In the toilet.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right.
So IRS records, FBI booking, and your band Clark Kent. There seems to be a theme of power and the deep state going on here. And I assume it has to do with your dad, Miles Copeland Jr., who is one of the founders of the actual Central Intelligence Agency, also known as the CIA.
Yeah.
Now, it's common knowledge that your dad was a spy. But what really blew my socks off is that when you lived in Beirut, Lebanon, as a kid, your family was friends with the family of Kim Philby, the most notorious double agent in the history of the Cold War. And you were even friends with Harry Philby, Kim's son, weren't you?
That's right. And after his dad disappeared to Russia, the family was destroyed, and I never saw Harry again. I haven't been able to find him. He has vanished off the face of the earth.
Huh.
You know, for the Copelands, it's all a laugh. Daddy was a secret agent man. He deposed governments, imposed dictators upon the people of far-off lands. Ha, ha, ha. We can laugh, kind of. But their daddy was a traitor.
Yeah.
Right.
And they were a very pukka English family. He was going to a nice boarding school and everything, and they were destroyed. And I never saw them again.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Was that his original wife or his second wife?
No, that was Eleanor, and he left her and the kids behind. He was on his way to a dinner party with my parents, among others, and didn't show up because he went down the harbor and jumped on a Greek ship headed for Sevastopol and was gone. And for 2 weeks, everyone said, where is Dad? And my dad and his cronies, they knew where he was, or they figured there was another British spy. They knew there was another leak, and it had to be Philby. But he was one of my father's best friends.
It's so painful.
Yeah, and he was devastated to have been lied to, and they were kind of coming to that conclusion. Then when he disappeared, they all knew. But us kids, all we knew was that something was weird going on with the Grups.
Wild.
That is so incredible. I mean, that is a crucible moment in the Cold War, and you were right there. That's jaw-dropping to me. Did your dad have any Cold War Spinal Tap moments that he shared with you that you could share with us without having us all murdered later?
Yeah, I could tell you, but I would have to kill you.
Go for it.
Okay, here's one. It was actually before I was born.
Okay,
but cool. My mom is pregnant with my brother Ian, and my father, he was in Syria, in Damascus, Syria, and the colonel who they had installed as El Presidente was beginning put on airs and thought that he was actually in charge of the place. And it was starting taking calls from the Ruskies, whose job was basically, they didn't build anything up. Their job was to destroy our network of potentates, dictators, despots, and assholes so that we could have the oil coming to the west rather than north to the east. It was all about the oil. There was no morality. There was no introducing democracy, none of that. It was the oil, period. Let's keep it simple. So they needed a regime change in Syria. And they're working up two or three different options of different colonels. But they picked one and said, here's what we're going to do. We get a rent-a-mob to come and invade an American diplomat's house.
Oh,
and
wow.
Creates a ruckus. They have to call out the army. And while the army's out, they take over the radio station in the palace and put in our guy, Abdul Shahab. And so you can guess which American diplomat was chosen for this honor.
Oh, boy.
And so my mother's packed off to a mountain village to, you know, see what happens. And my dad's in there with a couple of his buddies. And the Rent-A-Mob's late. And then shots ring out. Oh, wait. They've got guns? That's not what we paid for. And so it's getting violent. And there's, you know.
Unscripted.
Yeah, they're in the house there. And there's shots coming through the window. And my father's on the phone with Beirut, which is on the phone with Washington. And he's talking about what's going on. You know, guys, this is out of hand. But I got to hang up now. They're shooting at me personally.
Oh, boy.
Well, so your dad also was a jazzer, right?
Yeah. I got his trumpet right here.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Well, that's a very important point because I looked at the CIA website, Stuart. Your dad is, I guess, still under deep cover because this is what they wrote. And you tell me if it's true. Miles was fairly successful scoring gigs, playing with, and composing for the likes of Ray Noble, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Stan Kenton, Dave Brubeck, and Buddy Rich.
I do not believe that all of those names are true. And he would probably have been more proud of the Dorsey brothers.
Mm.
The only other one that's true is Glenn Miller, which was brief. And for my dad, that was sort of like a credit of playing with the Bay City Rollers or something. Not bragworthy, but the Dorsey brothers, he was very proud of that. He did not play with Buddy Rich, but I got to introduce my dad to Buddy Rich because they're both the same generation.
Oh, that's wow. Cool.
And my dad raised me up on Buddy Rich, which I didn't really get big band jazz. You know, my buddy Stanley Clark tells me that's because it's wrong jazz.
Hmm.
White big band jazz is wrong jazz, except for Buddy Rich. And so I was able in later years to take my dad to see Buddy Rich at the Ronnie Scott's Club in London. Amazing show. He does his thing. And his band are all young Juilliard cats, you know. Then we go backstage and all of Buddy's band are all lining up to get my autograph, observed by my father. And for my father, that was, okay, my son is worth some. Okay, I get it.
He's made it, yeah.
Yeah, he's made it. But then him and Buddy, two generations older than anyone else in the room, they're head-to-head talking about asshole club owners and band leaders that they both knew. And, you know, so they got along really well. But you have forced me to divulge another distinction and brag in my life. How many drummers can you name who have given their autograph to Buddy Rich?
So Buddy wow. Rich asked for your autograph?
Anything? Anybody? Yeah.
Wow.
He looked like he was chewing on a gerbil at the time, and it was for his daughter, Kathy.
Oh, boy.
Well, he's a notoriously prickly guy. Have you ever seen any of the videos of him
bitching
out his band?
Him shouting at the band.
So this happened at the Grammys?
Yeah. You know, they're Millet backstage. Everyone's standing around. Here comes Buddy Rich. There's Buddy Rich. Oh, my God. He's walking this direction. I'll just stand here and I'll be cool. Be cool. Be cool. He's walking up. He's walking up to me and he's talking to me. I can't even hear what he's saying because, you know, it's Buddy Rich, for God's sake. Then he gives me something. I don't know what it was, a beer mat or something. I don't know. So, here, can you sign this? And it was for his daughter. But with my hand trembling, I put in, I am just a nothing, Stuart. That's not what I put in. Well, I do have a little more cojones than that. I go, okay, motherfucker. You want my autograph? Buddy, you want my autograph? Here you go. You know, never mind the Grammy we won. Screw that.
Yeah.
Gave Buddy Rich my autograph.
In front of your dad?
No, he wasn't there that time.
Oh.
And what I did not do was get his autograph, which I regret.
Well, it was obviously a pure power play on your part.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020'd? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020'd, where myself, Benny Goodman, And my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, SoundTalentMedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Minahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!
At the 84 Grammys, it was kind of a police Michael Jackson battle royale, right? Synchronicity was nominated for a Grammy for the Album of the Year, as was Thriller.
Oh, hang on. Let me just check my Grammys, sir, and see who won.
Yeah.
Podcast audience, this is an audio of Stuart looking at his Grammys.
Michael took that one for Thriller.
Summon a bitch.
However, Every Breath You Take and Billie Jean were both up for Song of the Year, and Every Breath You Take took that Grammy. So,
well, I have enormous respect for the music of Michael Jackson, but Every Breath You Take is the better song. And has been proven by its weeks on the charts, the number of remakes. That song is one of the greatest songs of all time.
Yeah, there's quantitative data to back that up. I think you guys and MJ were both there. Were there any interesting interactions with the King of Pop that night?
We were introduced. He seemed a little distant, with a weird kind of high voice.
Right. Presumably you shook hands. Was he wearing the white gloves?
Speaks very quietly.
Yeah.
I don't recall any gloves.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Well, I think the period's really interesting too, because it's like the talkies, right? Like when the talkies hit, some actors faded, but when MTV hit and video became a big part of the music experience, some bands really took off, like you guys.
Because we were so pretty.
You guys are pretty.
That was it.
You know, not many people know this. Our first success as the Police was as a boy band. It was the tweens of London that picked up on us first. Hmm. And we were all over like the tween teeny bopper magazines with the three blonde heads looking all pretty. And now that we achieved some respectability from our actual depth of personality and musicianship, we can now be bragful about our origins as a boy band.
Yeah, it's funny.
Well, it's also very interesting, too, that you did not get the respect of the London scene because you are not pure punk.
Well, this is before that.
Oh, this is even before that? Wow.
Yeah, before we were a boy band, we were a fake punk band. Now, the boy band was not by choice. I mean, we'd struggled to be a punk band because that was the only scene happening. That was the only gigs that were happening. The only excitement, the only buzz was in the punk scene. So we had to pretend to be a punk band. And we struggled and struggled. And it wasn't until we got to America and started to verge into what might be called prog, where much more musicianship, more chops, more stuff going on musically than hardcore punk. And we began to find our sound and everything. And then we're over in America and we get a phone call. Hey, you've got a hit back in England. Cool. And we get back to England. And this is also recounted in my new book, The Stuart Copeland Police Diaries, where after all this struggle and travail, we get back to England and we finally have achieved success on the fronter of Tween magazine.
That's hysterical.
That is awesome.
We had Joey Santiago from the Pixies on, and he's very turned off by the entire punk genre because of the orthodoxy. I mean, you think it's this individuality, free spirit, be yourself.
Nope.
No, it's a rigid set of rules.
Absolutely.
And the Police didn't fit that.
Well, we tried.
You tried.
Well, they busted us because when Andy joined, he made the big step, which was to cut his hair, which was a big deal. That was your leaving all that you knew before. And the next time you show up with short hair instead of long hair, you have joined the enemy.
Right.
You have become one of the Thargons, who are the barbarians at the gate. And so when Andy joined the police and he cut his hair, we did a show with actually two guitarists. It was one of the few shows we played with both guitarists. And he comes out on the stage. He got the right hairdo. Cool, cool, cool. But he had not yet adjusted his collection of pants. He went out there with short hair and bell bottoms.
Oh, no.
That is too funny.
Unbelievable. So you're like in my favorite period in music history. I think 77 to 80 is just unbelievable. And I'm wondering how that impacted the police in terms of raising the bar of what you had to put out. Like, I'm just going to read you in 79, NME put out the best albums of the year. This is a sample. Obviously, Regatta de Blanc, which is my favorite police album. Fear of Music, Talking Heads, Squeezing Out the Sparks, Graham Parker, XTC, Drums and Wires, The Jam, Setting Suns. This is 1 year. Elvis Costello, Armed Forces, The Specials' first album, Joe Jackson, I'm the Man, and Bowie, Lodger.
Wait a minute. Is Blondie not on there? B-52s?
Yes, the B-52s were on there. I don't think Blondie's on there.
They were amazing. They amazing. Were one of the best bands of all time.
Don't you think that made the police raise their game a little bit? I mean, you know, you look at during the Salon in the 19th century in Paris. I mean, all the great artists that happened at the same time, they influenced each other, just like the bands of the 70s influenced each other.
Well, we realized that we would have to join the stampede before we could lead it. But the reason you picked that period as the best time of all time is because you were a human being, and human beings are like ducks. And the thing that we share with ducks is that when a duck busts out of its shell, it uses its little beak to push out, and it comes down and greets the world. And the first warm being it sees is mama. And that's how ducks decide who mama is. Well, us humans, when we get to 16 and we start to burst out of our little family shell and look out at the world and we need some rebellion going on, the first hairy guitar player we see, or singer, or purveyor of rebellion, that's your daddy. And for me, it was Jimi Hendrix. And for you, it was the Ramones and all those bands you just mentioned.
I never saw in any of your credentials, Stuart, that you're a waterfowl ornithologist. So that is an extraordinary revelation on this show.
Hey, what?
A waterfowl ornithologist, a duck expert.
I just made all that shit up. I'm no expert. I'm just a fabulist.
You are a fabulist. So you and I, Stuart, were both tour managers.
Oh, yeah.
I love this joke from Monty Melnick, who was the Ramones tour manager. He said, you know what the difference is between a tour manager and a toilet bowl?
Oh, dealing one asshole at a time.
Toilet bowl only takes shit from one asshole at a time. That's exactly right.
That's right, yeah.
So can you share a crazy story from when you wore the two hats of both drumming in the police and tour managing the police?
Well, tour managing the police in the early days was all about just booking the trucks and dealing with administration and booking the gigs and selling records off of my big brother Miles's phone book. He had a record company and he would let me go in there and use his phones and, more importantly, his Rolodex and, of course, his advice and stuff. But basically, I was in there hustling. And we take the ferry from England over to Holland and we place a couple shows with the Electric Chairs and the Damned. And then we're coming back and Sting and Andy are on the bus and I'm in the customs shed doing the paperwork, the carnet. You have to declare every piece of equipment. It's serial number, it's value. They check it going in, they check it coming out. This is before the common market. It was such a pain. I'm there doing the paperwork and there's a hassle. And oh my God. And I look up in the customs shed. It's got a window behind the guy. And I look, I can see the ferry is leaving.
Oh,
hello.
No.
Well, I guess I just missed the boat. Oh, damn. So Sting and Andy are on their way home and I'm stuck in Holland. I get on the next ferry and it's like a 3-hour whatever ferry ride. Then I get to the British customs shed and alone. First of all, I'm American. What are you doing in England? I live here. Where's your work permit? Dog ate my work permit. And by the way, that guitar you're carrying, I was carrying one of Andy's two guitars. Mm. What guitar is that? Now, is this the Strat or the SG. I don't know. Customs guys don't like that.
No, they sure don't.
There's not much funny about that story, but it's a story.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had the experience of crossing with bands from the U.S. into Canada, for example.
Oh, yeah, same thing.
Yeah, very much the same thing. And I remember being with Radiohead crossing from Detroit into Toronto, you know, being at the customs booth in the middle of the night. Everybody had their papers, fortunately, in place, so we weren't getting any hassled. But our bus driver, as they gave passports back, they're calling everybody's full name.
And this is where you learn the full names of all your
crew. Right. Yeah.
Cornelius? You're kidding.
Yeah. Tom, Edward York, Jonathan, Richard Guy, Greenwood, etc. And the bus driver, they held up his passport. They said, John Wayne Morgan. And the whole band just starts to sort of titter in the background. Like, we have John Wayne driving our bus. You know, you mentioned being these blonde heartthrobs, and I will post on Reddit to get questions from fans. So I posted in the Police subreddit, what should I ask Stuart? And Matt Sean Ryan 20 commented, ask him if the Police really dyed their hair blonde to be in a chewing gum commercial. And I know the commercial happened, but it sounds like you guys were already blonde.
Well, I was kind of dishwater blonde all along. When I was a kid, I was platinum blonde. But, you know, as with my children, they all start out platinum blonde. By the time they get adulthood, they're kind of dishwater.
Mm.
So I stuck my head in a bucket of peroxide and bleached it because that's what the punk thing was, you know, so I could look like Billy Idol.
Right.
The other guys were not convinced until we went to do the famous Wrigley's chewing gum commercial. And the art director says, we need a punk band. Part of the gimmick of the image was the agent's on the phone. He's got, you know, a punk band chewing up his office and whatever. And he pulls out a stick of chewing gum and everything's fine. Okay, well, we need a wilder looking punk band. Let's peroxide all their hair. So they stuck Andy and Sting's head in a bucket of peroxide. And so was born the three blonde heads.
That is nuts.
That's awesome. I want to ask you one more question. I was in a band called the Falling Willendas.
Cool name.
Thank you. And our drummer was a guy named Todd Zuckerman. You may know him. I think you judged a competition with him at Guitar Center or something. But anyways, I wanted to get a geeky drum question. This is what Todd asked, and I had to actually go on Google Translate and go to the drummer input to figure this out. But he says, why did you go with two different hoops on your 70s chrome over brass pearl snare drum? Die cast on top, triple flanged on the bottom. To me, I don't know what that means, but that was meaningful to Todd.
I know exactly what he means. And that same drum is right here. Your folks can't see it, but here it is. You can hear it.
Wow.
That snare drum right there is the one that I played in Curved Air all the way through the 8 years of Police on every Police record, on every Police tour.
Amazing.
And I do not know. I've got a picture in my book, Police Diaries by Stuart Coben, whatever it's called. Thank you. There's a picture of me in my home studio in 1977, and there it is in the corner over there. I know that I had it in 1976, and I still got it in the year of our Lord in 2023, but it just had a sound. And I don't know why it had two different hoops, and I would lose sleep. You know, am I going to lose this drum? Oh my God, it's the only one. Whenever I'd break a skin during a show and Jeff would switch it out and I got the other one, which is supposed to be the same, but it just ain't the same. So eventually when Tama Drums said, hey, let's do a signature snare, I said, reproduce this. And I sent the drum over to Japan and they analyzed the metallurgy, the angle of the rims, every aspect of the drum. And they would send me prototypes. Nope. Till finally they got it.
Hmm.
And I sleep well at nights because I've got 10, any number I want of this drum, which is for sale all over the world. In fact, here it is.
That's it.
Before we let you go, Stuart, I got to ask you about one of my favorite bands, The Doors.
Oh, yeah.
When I was in junior high school, they were absolutely my favorite band. You were out with, if I'm not mistaken, Ian Astbury from The Cult as the singer, right? Original Doors members Ray Manzarek and Robbie Krieger, and you were on drums. And I think there was a lawsuit from John Densmore, the Doors' original drummer at that time. There's got to be a Spinal Tap moment from touring with the legendary Doors.
Well, I was a big fan myself. They were my daddy. When I busted out, the Doors were right there. And so they are deep in my DNA.
And to play with him was a huge honor, to be sitting there with Ray Manzarek just playing that keyboard parts. And Robbie, I'm playing with the Doors. And it sounded just perfect. And Ian Astbury actually was doing a pretty good job impersonating Morrison. I couldn't believe it. One problem was that I was so absolutely the wrong guy. Much as I grew up on Densmore, I'm not him. And I got my own thing, which by that time was so established that I'm kind of tough for me to be somebody else. And Densmore does trance. He just gets a groove going and it just carries you forward. Me, I do explosion. And so it didn't fit. We were not a good match. And honored as I was, we were not a good match. Huh. And so it didn't last long. And then Densmore started his suit, which meant that the whole use of the band name was a problem. And they called me into court as a witness for Densmore, but it was all resolved. But they have their differences. And sadly, Ray is gone. Robbie is in excellent shape. And so is Densmore.
I feel like Robbie and John may have reconciled at this point.
Yeah, they have. Absolutely. Ray was a difficult personality. Complicated man, not Mr. Cozy, and I'm sure without Ray around, no reason for Robbie and Densmore to not get along.
Yeah. I used to live in West Hollywood, one block below Sunset Boulevard, and I once took a too fast of a left turn onto Sunset and almost ran over Ray and Dorothy Manzarek. So I'm glad I didn't take out a door that time. But
yeah.
You've been with a lot of difficult people. Like, you were friends with Ginger Baker, weren't you?
Yep. There's a difficult man. Beware Mr. Baker. If you go on YouTube and check out Stuart Copeland, Sacred Grove, and you will see me jamming with Neil Peart, with Stanley Clarke, Snoop Dogg, and whatever. And one day Ginger comes over and I got him on the drums and he's all grumpy. He plays like about a minute, which I had my cameras rolling. And I'm accompanying him. It wasn't until I played back the tape that I realized what meter he was playing in. And there's a little clip on YouTube of him and I for 1 minute. I got 1 minute. And about a minute after that, the paramedics arrived and wanted to cart him off because he was having heart palpitations or something.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, truly, truly ancient. And they're trying to say, well, we have to take you down and have a look at you, sir. And he's going, fuck off. I ain't getting no fucking ambulance. Fuck off with your hospital.
Oh, just so everyone knows, Ginger Baker was the drummer of Cream, and he's kind of a notorious figure in that if you read anything, he disses pretty much every other drummer that ever lived except himself. And he was a fantastic drummer.
Well, he was kind to me.
Good.
That's nice.
He called me young man. And Ginger can call me whatever he wants.
He probably heard that Buddy Rich asked for your autograph.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. You got the Buddy Rich armor. So, Stuart, this has been so much fun.
Thank you.
It's
so great.
Where can our listeners keep up on your prolific projects? They are just never ending.
Instagram, Stuart_Copeland. And I've got a team who pulls up stuff and I just do the captions. And occasionally I'll take a picture of my damn self and post that. I would say Instagram, but check out my YouTube site.
Right. And that's under your name as well, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Lots of really wonderful things there.
Yeah. It's really great. You're like such a presence on YouTube and TikTok too, aren't you?
Yes, but that's by remote control because I disapprove, but I can't ignore it. So every now and then I'll go on and see how I'm doing. And occasionally I have to create content specifically for them, because one good thing about them is that their algorithms are humans. They decide as humans, sentient beings, what they're going to run and not run, which is good rather than an algorithm, but bad because you got to kiss their ass.
That old trick.
Yes, we've got the lips for it in the music business for sure.
You can't kiss the ass of an algorithm.
Not yet. Just wait.
We'll put AI on it. We'll figure that out too.
Listeners, how best to sum up Stuart Copeland? He's a container ship full of stories. He's a fire hose of fun. He's a big bang of, well, I don't know, big bangs, as one of the greatest living drummers should be. That was really special. Thanks to Tarquin Gotch and Katie Johnston from Stuart's management company, as well as Grace Fleischer and Maddie Eventoff at Shorefire Media for helping us to set up our time with Stuart. Much appreciated. Too Much Effing Perspective is a Milwaukee Talkies original. Our editor is Gretchen Kilby. Our music composer is J.K. Harrison. Please follow us on Instagram at TMEP Show. Visit our website at tmepshow.com to sign up for our mailing list and find our other episodes featuring rock stars, comedians, and entertainment luminaries on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen.
Although it would be as great as having armadillos in our trousers, this podcast is not affiliated with This Is Spinal Tap, and no person or entity connected with the film has sponsored or endorsed its content. The podcast is not affiliated, sponsored, or licensed by Authorized Spinal Tap LLC or Century of Progress Productions. TMEP show folk, this is Alan. I want to end the show a little differently this week. Back in the mid-1990s, my band, The Falling Willendas, did an interpretation of the Police song, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, that appeared on a 1980s compilation album out of Milwaukee called Gag Me With a Spoon. I'm going to play that cut right now. Why don't you drop me a line at hello@tmepshow.com or on Instagram and let me know what you think of it. I'd appreciate it. And you know, every breath you guys take is magic to me.
Oh, I try so hard to tell her all the feelings I have for her. My nerve is I've done from the start. Do I have to tell a story of a thousand rainy days since we first met? It's a big enough umbrella, but it's always me that ends up getting
Well, hey, podcast listener, my name is Vince, and I'm the host of a show called The RR Show. It stands for Reddit Readings. We're going to sit down twice a week, and I'm going to bring you the most entertaining stories from all of the best subreddits that exist online. Things like malicious compliance, petty revenge, hey, lady, I don't work here. Oh, there's so much more. Lots of great stories and things you won't believe. Like the one time this dude was caught in a bathroom with his friend and he was slapping them because that was the only way that he could actually legitimately help them. A mall cop comes in with a taser. Oh, yeah. The rest is history. It's going to be fun. There is, I don't know. I got like 20 seconds left, so I don't got much more time to tell you another story. But just join me on The RR Show. It's from Evergreen Podcast, produced in partnership with Wessler Media. So The RR Show. Wherever you get podcasts, subscribe today. And it's like an adult story time. Let's hang out together. The RR Show. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts.
Evergreen Podcast Network.